Strip tops 33,600. Lebanon's resistance movement Hezbollah has targeted Israeli positions in the occupied territories with a barrage of rockets. And the Iran's foreign minister says his country has always played a constructive role in order to secure the stability of the region. Thank you for joining us. The Israeli military's relentless attacks on the Gaza Strip continue to take more civilian lives. At least 29 people were killed when a home in central Gaza City was hit. Another 20 civilians lost their lives in Israeli strikes on other areas across the coastal sliver. Israeli forces also targeted a number of journalists in the Nuseirat camp, central Gaza, causing casualties. According to medical sources, one of the journalists is in critical condition. More than 33,600 people have been killed in Gaza since Israel began its genocidal war. Thousands more remain missing. A Geneva-based human rights organization has estimated that over 13,000 Gazans are unaccounted for. Euromed Human Rights Monitor says many of those missing are either under the rubble or have been buried in indiscriminate mass graves. Our correspondent Moti Abu Musabbeh joined us earlier from the central Gaza city of Deir al-Balah to give us an update on the latest Israeli attacks against the besieged Palestinian territory. Let's take a listen.
Israeli attacks are still continued so far, as you know, against Nuseirat refugee camp. More relentless airstrikes and more attacks carried out by the Israeli artillery shelling are still carried out against that refugee camp. The latest attack, as you have mentioned, targeted a group of the Palestinian journalists who were gathering in that area, covering the latest developments on the ground. The Israeli occupation forces deliberately attacked them. That attack actually was documented on the camera, whereas an Israeli tank actually fired a shell towards those Palestinian journalists directly. At least three Palestinian journalists were reportedly injured over that attack. One of them had his right leg actually amputated. He's Sami Shahada. He's the correspondent of TRT channel. He was documenting the current aggression in the Nuseirat refugee camp. So it's another deliberate crime committed by the Israeli occupation forces against the Palestinian journalists on the ground here, taking the whole number of the Palestinian journalists who have been attacked and who have been killed by the Israeli occupation forces to roughly 140 Palestinian journalists, in addition to hundreds of the Palestinian journalists who got injured over those ceaseless attacks pursued by the Israeli occupation forces against the Palestinian media in a way that that aims at muting the voice of the Palestinian people and preventing those Palestinian journalists from covering the truth.
A UNICEF car came under fire in northern Gaza earlier this week on its way to deliver aid to malnourished children. That was the latest incident of targeting aid groups by Israeli forces in Gaza, where people are already starving due to the regime's restrictions. Now let's take a listen to a UNICEF spokesperson explaining how the attack happened.
I was in that car that was hit. It was waiting at a holding point just south of the Wadi Gaza checkpoint, where we are often instructed to wait before being called through the checkpoint. We were waiting there as instructed, and gunfire broke out in the vicinity. It seemed to be coming from the direction of the checkpoint towards civilians, who then turned and fled from the checkpoint. Luckily, myself and my colleagues, we were all safe, but this just underscores how dangerous it is for humanitarian aid workers in Gaza at the moment, that incidents like this continue to happen when they absolutely shouldn't. See, we decided to go ahead because it was such a critical mission, with nutrition products for the children who are malnourished in the north of Gaza, among other things. Unfortunately, after deciding that we would go ahead, we were still delayed. We waited at that holding point for at least another 2 hours before deciding that the mission was no longer feasible because we didn't have enough time, even if we were given the green light, to go up, conduct all of our activities, and then get. It's tragic to see anybody suffering from malnutrition, which is such a painful condition, let alone in a place where malnutrition was almost non-existent before October. It's now skyrocketed in the north of Gaza because of disruptions to food production, but also because of restrictions on aid access to that area. We've really struggled to get up there with aid. And as a result, we know that children are dying of malnutrition there. At least 23 children have reportedly died at the Kamal Adwan Hospital, which is where we were trying to bring these nutrition treatments on Tuesday.
West Bank have held a funeral for two Palestinians who were killed in an Israeli raid. The two Palestinians were killed in the city of Tubas in the northeast of the West Bank. Mohammed Rasul Darahme was killed after Israeli occupying forces opened fire at his vehicle. Elsewhere in the Central Bank, armed Israeli settlers attacked two villages near the city of Ramallah. One Palestinian was killed and over 20 people were injured. The settlers also set dozens of Palestinian cars and houses on fire. There has been a drastic rise in the number of attacks by Israeli forces and settlers against Palestinians in the West Bank since the regime launched its genocidal war on Gaza in early October. Since then, at least 462 Palestinians have been killed in the occupied territory. Our correspondent in Ramallah joined us earlier with more details about the Israeli settlers' attack on a village near Ramallah that killed a Palestinian man and injured several others. Let's take a listen.
A third Palestinian has been killed by the Israelis this day, but this time Israeli settlers had killed a young Palestinian man, Jihad Afif Abu Aliya, from the village of Al-Mghayr, northeast Ramallah. The Israeli settlers had raided the village of Al-Mghayr, and they attacked Palestinians and their vehicles, their homes. They burnt properties, they burnt vehicles, they opened fire at the residents of Al-Mghayr, killing one Palestinian and wounding 18 others. At the same time, Israeli forces stormed Al-Mghayr in order, of course, to make sure that the settlers are not being attacked or hurt by the Palestinians there, and at the same time to continue attacking the Palestinians there. Why the Israeli settlers had been raiding Al-Mghayr, it's not the first time. The Israeli settlers continue to storm these areas, northeast Ramallah, like Al-Mghayr, Tir Musa'iyya, Sinjal, and these Palestinian towns and villages are located very close to the illegal settlements that are built on the Palestinian lands. The Israeli authorities claim that a Shepherd settler, was still missing since the early hours of Friday, and the search is still continuing. They could not, of course, find this settler.
Lebanon's resistance movement Hezbollah and Israeli forces have once again exchanged fire as the southern Lebanese border remains tense over the onslaught on Gaza. Hezbollah says it has fired dozens of rockets towards occupied Palestine and the occupied Golan Heights. That after Israeli warplanes targeted several Lebanese villages and towns. Earlier we were joined by a correspondent in Beirut, Mayam Saleh, for more details.
Was definitely basically keeping things at a low profile. There was low intensity operations from Lebanon, but we noticed that from the Israeli side, the shelling continued, and we saw an intensification today where they launched and targeted several houses in Ain Tashah, but also in the town of Taibe, which is still one of the towns that is inhabited. It has not been displaced. It has not been evacuated. It's not a bordering town. So Hezbollah basically made a stance with what we heard from the launching of the Katyusha rockets. Hezbollah has mentioned in their statement that they said tens of rockets were launched towards the barracks of Zaoura. Zaoura is one of the main barracks where the Israelis basically launch their artillery. It's a launching site. They have many vehicles over there, artillery vehicles especially. They're usually also Merkava tanks in that barrack specifically. So basically it's a very large military parking lot for their artillery vehicles. Hezbollah made it clear that they are ready to make that stance and to retaliate for the targeting of areas that are considered residential and civilian, although we did not see, we don't have clear casualties from the civilian population, but still in itself, when the Israelis target a civilian house and it is destroyed, then Hezbollah does retaliate in that manner. And we saw that Hezbollah also have taken things a little bit further. After this targeting, they issued some four statements saying that they launched several operations during the day. So after some de-escalation, now we see that the resistance in Lebanon has gone back to the same routine of continuous heavy firing against Israeli targets, whether in the Golan Heights or in occupied Palestinian territory, in occupied Lebanese territory. We have two operations in the Kfar Shuba Hills, the Lebanese occupied Kfar Shuba Hills in Al Samarqa.
Iran's foreign minister says Tehran has always acted constructively in regional issues and has paid a huge price in order to ensure the stability and sustainable security of the West Asia region. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the remark during a phone call with his Italian counterpart. He also urged Italy to use its presidency of the G7 group of countries to try to end the Israeli genocide in Gaza. Antonio Tajani, for his part, stated that Italy, alongside the EU, has condemned Israel's attack on Iran's embassy in Syria, but called on the Islamic Republic to exercise restraint. The Irish and Spanish leaders in a joint press conference in Dublin affirmed their commitment to recognize Palestine as a state as soon as possible.
The international community will not be able to help Palestine if it does not recognize its existence. That is why our two countries are publicly committed to recognize Palestine as a state as soon as possible, when the conditions are appropriate. And we also pledge to support the recognition of Palestine as a full member state of the United Nations.
Sanchez also said Spain and Ireland agree on the urgency of an immediate ceasefire in the Gaza Strip and the delivery of more humanitarian aid to Palestinians. Also, the Irish Prime Minister said his country is now much closer to the recognition of the Palestinian state. Ireland and Spain have repeatedly signaled their intention to recognize a Palestine's statehood. The Spanish Premier is now on a European tour to drum out support for the move. Earlier, Norway's Prime Minister echoed the sentiment that such a decision would need to be taken in close coordination with like-minded countries. And last but not least, to wrap up the bulletin, Russia says it is open for peace talks with Ukraine based on a 2022 draft peace agreement. However, Moscow says Kiev shows no sign of willingness for negotiations. We have discussed the issue with the possibility of ceasefire negotiations between Moscow and Kiev in our news review program.
On this segment of the program, Russia says a draft peace agreement that was negotiated with Ukraine in 2022 could serve as a starting point for a new round of negotiations between the two countries. The Kremlin spokesman said any potential future talks would need to consider, quote, new realities, echoing the Russian president's remarks on Thursday. Dmitry Peskov added a lot has changed since 2022, including what he said was the addition of four new regions to Russian territory. The draft document that was discussed in Istanbul in 2022 reportedly includes clauses demanding that Ukraine adopt a geopolitically neutral status and not join NATO, limit the size of its armed forces, and grant a special status to eastern Ukraine. Moscow, however, says there is no sign that Kiev is ready for peace talks. Well, joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have radio host and journalist at CPR News, Don DeBar, who's joining us from Ossining, New York. And we also have independent researcher and author Greg Simons, who's joining us from Uppsala, Sweden. Let's start off with Mr. DeBar. I want to get your perspective on the recent comments coming from Russia that this previous draft peace agreement that was negotiated back in 2022 could actually serve as a starting point for a new round of negotiations. Are you optimistic about that?
First, the first impression I have of this is that Ukraine is going to keep because the last time they did that, and that their representative negotiated a treaty, when he got back home to Kiev, they killed him and called him a traitor. So there's that problem. Of course, there are the various efforts by states and others to negotiate some sort of a peace settlement with everyone but Russia, which is insane, of course. Obviously political for consumption at home, not anything that's going to be considered, you know, on the global stage or that's going to be considered by Russia. There have been other agreements. In December of 2022, before the special military operation, as Russia calls it, began, that phase of war began, there were documents sent to NATO and Washington laying out what Russia's concerns were with having basically, you know, an active war directed at Russia conducted on its border. And that was rejected. There were the Minsk agreements that were negotiated and signed over the period of, you know, from post-coup in 2014, that also we found out not only were they not implemented, everyone knew that because the Donbass area was not given autonomy, which was the consideration for it, but also that the individuals from the West who negotiated it admitted publicly, we never intended to carry our part of the bargain. We were just trying to buy time to arm for a war with Russia. So the foundation for this is on pretty shaky ground. Obviously, the logic of any war is that it should be ended through negotiations that are fair and settle the underlying problems between the belligerents or the antagonists. It just doesn't seem that there's anyone that can do that on behalf of Kiev, since Kiev really is nothing but, you know, an agent of Washington, and Washington is trying to damage Russia.
Greg Simons, I want to get your thoughts on the issue as well, whether this draft agreement will lead anywhere, and whether you agree with our guest, Mr. Don DeBar, that maybe Kiev isn't even actually looking for peace.
Well, I agree fully with Don. I would also add, the moment that Zelensky agreed to go to war against Russia, Ukraine lost all its sovereignty. It became nothing more than a puppet of the United States, and a very desperate and delusional United States that has banked everything on Ukraine winning the war so that it can sort of stop Russia's rise. In addition to that, I would also add that, I mean, the point is Ukraine is in a much worse military, political, economic position now in 2024, in April 2024, than it was in March 2022 in Istanbul. So, I mean, what do they have to bargain with? I mean, they're now trying to scrape the bottom of the barrel for anyone who hasn't run away from conscription or is dead yet.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. Radio host and journalist at CPR News, Don DeBar, joining us from Ossining, New York, and independent researcher and author Greg Simons, joining us from Uppsala, Sweden. And with that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. Now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
The deliberate targeting of Gaza health infrastructure, manufactured scarcity of medical supplies and fuel, and restricted access to basic necessities are all different means through which the destruction of healthcare has been used as a weapon of war by the child killer regime of Israel. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned, please. Crescent International wrote, "The Zionist regime army has been relentless in its targeting of healthcare workers and infrastructure in Gaza. This is not a new strategy employed by the Zionist regime. Health has, for years, been previously documented as being used as a weapon against the occupied Palestinian population. While this is not a novel concept in modern-day warfare, we have not seen the tactic used on such a large scale to strangulate a population before. The deliberate targeting of health infrastructure, manufactured scarcity of medical supplies and fuel, and restricted access to basic necessities are all different means through which the destruction of healthcare has been used as a weapon of war. With these actions, the Zionist regime seeks to amplify the scale of human losses inflicted on civilians in the Gaza Strip and push the survivors into exodus." Prior to October 7, 2023, healthcare system in Gaza were already teetering on the brink, with only 36 hospitals operating at full capacity and a total of 3,412 beds catering to a population exceeding 2 million people. This data indicates a maximum ratio of 1.55 hospitals beds per 1,000 individuals across the entire region. Patients requiring access to specialized treatment outside of Gaza have routinely been prevented from exiting. In 2021 alone, over 36% of requests for medical permits were either refused or left unanswered by Israeli occupation authorities, condemning patients with urgent conditions to preventable deaths. In January this year, the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs released statistics related to the medical situation being faced in Gaza due to the unrelenting Israeli aggression. 337 healthcare workers have been martyred. 145 UN staff have been killed. 14 of 36 hospitals in Gaza are only partially functional, and they suffer from outages and major shortages of medical supplies. 26 of 36 hospitals in Gaza are damaged. 122 ambulances have been damaged. 1.9 million Gaza residents are displaced. The numbers are shocking, and the extent of damage is unfathomable, difficult to comprehend through numbers alone. By November 2023, all hospitals in northern Gaza were completely out of service. It was at this point that we witnessed the Zionist regime leading armed invasions of hospitals, including the largest medical complex in the region, Ash-Shifa, and the Indonesian hospital, which at the time was the last remaining operational hospital in northern Gaza. This demonstrates a sustained and orchestrated Israeli policy to destroy healthcare facilities, forcing their evacuation. Despite claims by the Zionist regime army that armed Palestinian groups have used health facilities for military purposes, according to Human Rights Watch, no evidence has yet been presented that provides legal justification for the loss of the protected status of hospitals and other health infrastructure as codified by international humanitarian law. An extensive Washington Post investigation of the Zionist regime's attacks and invasion of Ash-Shifa Hospital found that the evidence provided by Israel does not demonstrate that the hospital was being used as a command and control center, nor that the hospital building is connected to a larger tunnel network. Notably, the burden of proof remains with the accuser to provide adequate evidence that the protected status of a health facility has been lost. In case of doubt, there should be a presumption of civilian status. If a health facility lost its protected status, the principles of proportionality, precaution, and distinction still apply. Despite these clear international laws, the destruction of the healthcare system has been the main thrust of the Zionist occupation army's clear strategy. Repeated patterns of these attacks indicate that damages inflicted on Gaza's already precarious health system and the systematic murder of medical staff are part of a broader strategy seeking to weaponize healthcare. Despite these clear international laws, the destruction of the healthcare system has been the main thrust of the Zionist occupation army's clear strategy. Beyond overt destruction, UNICEF released its report number 20, documenting the broader health-related impacts being suffered by the civilian Gaza population. They include high levels of displacement and overcrowding in collective centers and scattered sites in the Gaza Strip continue with extremely challenging hygiene and sanitation conditions. On average, 340 individuals share one toilet and 1,200 290 persons share one shower. The babies of 5,500 women who are due to give birth in the next month in the Gaza Strip are at risk of dying, as their mothers do not have access to prenatal or postnatal checkups because of bombings and need to flee for safety. Anxiety is also leading to premature births, as reported by the United Nations Population Fund, UNFPA. Over 90% of children aged 6 to 23 months and pregnant, breastfeeding women face severe food poverty with access to two or fewer food groups per day. In addition, withdrawal of fuel and power sources and the closure of all humanitarian corridors for the delivery of aid has created dire conditions for the outbreak of multiple epidemics. Cases of scabies, lice, chickenpox, skin rash, hepatitis A, and upper respiratory infections have been reportedly rising in a context of disrupted vaccination campaigns and disease surveillance systems. The weaponization of healthcare negates the right to exist and resist. It is a means of collectively punishing a population and discouraging or deterring any form of resistance, whether peaceful or violent. Attacking so disproportionately against a civilian population not only contradicts the basic tenets of international humanitarian law, it also perpetuates structural power imbalances born out of the asymmetry seen between the colonizer and the colonized. By instilling fear, physical and psychological trauma, the weaponization of health is instrumental to forcibly displace Palestinians by means of rendering Gaza uninhabitable and hostile. Any credible commitment to and movement for health justice must see both the ongoing and long-standing violence against healthcare workers and attacks against healthcare in this context as an extension of the systematic campaign of violence and oppression against the Palestinian people.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
And God said, "Let there be light," and there was light.
The Creator made Adam in His image, then placed the world in His care. May you walk alongside the Creator in righteousness.
God of Abraham, take my child into thy hands, that he may live to thy service.
God has spoken to us before, through Abraham, Noah, Moses, and through Jesus Christ. Why should we be so surprised that God speaks to us now through Muhammad?
Viewpoint.
A critique of movies with religious themes on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program, Viewpoint, the movie critique program, in which we try to criticize movies with religious and spiritual themes. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and my guest speakers, as always, Brother Yasser and Sayyid Abdullah. Brother Yasser, assalamu alaikum, and welcome to the program.
Alaykum salam wa rahmatullah. I was blessed with you, Brother Muhammad Jawad.
You're welcome. And Sayyid Abdullah, assalamu alaikum, and welcome to the studio again.
Wa alaykum salam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me, as always.
You're welcome. And it's a pleasure, actually, to have you back in the studio, helping me criticize a couple of movies which are related to religion or with the theme of religions and spirituality. And one of those movies that we are going to, in fact, criticize is Ouija, Origin of Evil, produced in 2016, directed by Mike Flanagan. Before we start criticizing this movie, let's take a short break, and then we'll be back with the program and with the help of my guest speakers, criticize this movie. Don't go away.
Let's begin. We invite you into our circle. If that's you, give us a sign.
This is a scam.
We do not attack the clients.
We help people. We give them closure. It's a
time. You are so weird.
Does she have a lot of problems?
It's nothing too concerning.
What's this?
A Ouija board for work. Give
it to me. Spirit, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Who are you talking to?
What?
Back to the program. Viewpoint, the movie critique program on RIB English Radio with me, Mohammad Jawad, hosting this program, and my guest speakers, Brother Yasser and Sayyid Abdullah. Well, Sayyid Abdullah, let me start with you about this movie. In fact, this movie is about a widow and her two daughters using a Ouija board to help people move on with their lives. They interact with a spirit, but are unaware of the fact that it has possessed Doris, the youngest daughter. Well, it, you know, this movie features a couple of actors and actresses, such as Lulu Wilson, Elizabeth Reeser, Annalisa Basso, Kate Siegel, just to name a few. And, you know, Rotten Tomatoes gives this movie the approval rating of 84%, IMDb 6.2 out of 10, and the box office for this was 81.7 million, although the budget for this movie was ranging between $9 and $12 million. Let's talk about this movie. How did you like it? And what's a Ouija board?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I'm not very, very fond of these kind of movies where they summon the spirit, because the idea doesn't go through my head. Nevertheless, the movie was okay. It was, if you're into horror movies and trying to scare yourself, it does a job, I guess. And considering that it's yeah, and considering its box office success,
yes,
compared to its budget, it done all right. So it, you know, it had that dark theme to it, and that possession and exorcism and whatever you call it. So, like I said, it's not my cup of tea, but it was watchable to a certain extent. I didn't mind it. So I would definitely give it like 3 or 4 out of 10 because I'm not into the genre. The Ouija board, it's something that's been used for a long time, I think over 100 years now or yes. So. Where there's a board where it's, you know, you put a triangle and then people place their hands and then the board itself moves to the letters and then you have to spell them out because apparently
there's a planchette.
Planchette. So the spirit's supposed to be talking to you. And it's been used in the public culture for a long time now where people try to communicate with spirits.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, thank you very much, Sayyid Abdullah. Let's take a short break, and then we'll be back and, you know, pick Brother Yasser's brain too for this movie. Stay with us.
Daddy. Are you there? Who are you?
Your sister's taking you to school today.
I don't want to go! I'm gonna stay here and talk to my friends.
What friends?
I'll show you. Are you here?
Back to the program, Viewpoint, the movie critique program on RIB English Radio with me, Mohammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sayyid Abdullah and Brother Yasser, my guest speakers, helping me criticize the movie Ouija, Origin of Evil, produced in 2016, directed by Mike Flanagan. Well, Brother Yasser, let me ask you about the Ouija boards. Where does it come from? Where does the idea come from? Do you know anything about the history of the Ouija boards?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I can't say I do. It may be a medieval instrument that was probably used during the time of, you know, witchcraft or satanic kind of rituals. Maybe it's a way to kind of, like you mentioned in the movie, a way that communicates with a world beyond the physical realm. Again, a realm within the physical realm, but that's beyond our kind of sight, our physical sight anyway. One thing that is also interesting is that it's something that obviously over a period of time has continued, wherever it's come from. So therefore, in order for it to continue, it must have shown results. If somebody says that, okay, you know, this worked, or it can work, or it has worked, therefore it shows, okay, if it has a continuation, it shows that somewhere down the line it worked, or gave results, or whatever it may be.
You mean it survived the test
of time? It survived the test of time, basically, because it showed results, right?
Exactly.
If it didn't, okay, you know, throw it away. Also,
but there could be like rumors around.
Rumors around it, you know, maybe things written about it, they may not have been true. Exaggerations. Again, the actual history behind it, I wouldn't know. But there's also another thing that is important that we've spoken about this previously as well, is that within the world of creation, there are also forces that kind of push these demonic things. I mean, for example, I think one of the our previous things, the Book of Diablo, for example, we kind of discuss. Does such a book even exist?
Yeah.
You know, can we just deny it because we don't know every knowledge of it? No. So there are obviously
with the movie The Ninth Gate.
Something
with, Johnny Depp.
Yeah. So things like this, for example, you know, is it a tool that these forces or these evil forces within the world of creation gave to human beings in order to kind of move them away from their ultimate and obviously. You know, purpose of creation. It's possible. Like.
Thank you very much, Brother Yasser. Let's take a short break and take a listen to a part of this movie, Ouija, Origin of Evil, produced in 2016, directed by Mike Flanagan, and then we'll be back and continue our program, Viewpoints, a movie critique program on RIB English Radio. Don't go away.
Something is happening that we can't understand.
I'm concerned about your girl.
What's this about, Father?
What are you doing? I'm not doing it!
The spirit world is dangerous.
They were watching us all those years.
By using the board, you've opened up a portal.
Back to the program, Viewpoints, the movie critique program on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program. And my guest speakers, Sayyid Abdullah and Brother Yasser, helping me criticize the movie Ouija, Origin of Evil, produced in 2016, directed by Mike Flanagan. Sayyid Abdullah, you know, in the approximately early part of this movie, there's a conversation within the family members that use this Ouija board, and the whole movie is revolving around this family. They are talking about actually a priest that is going to be actually introduced into the movie, right, injected. And they talk of the priest as not being allowed to marry. Is there any reason for the priest not to marry at all?
According to the Roman Catholic Church, they have this celibacy vow where a priest are not allowed to marry. So in terms of the church itself, the Catholic Church, they said that the priests, they need to at least in their lifestyle, they need to resemble Jesus Christ himself, because Jesus was unmarried. So the priest needs to be unmarried, that's one. Two, he needs to devote his life to the church. So based on that, the church themselves, they set a law that the priest must take a vow of celibacy, which means he's not allowed to get married. So if a priest takes a vow not to get married, then he has to obviously uphold his vow not to get married.
Is there any evidence supporting the claim, like Jesus was celibate?
We Islamically and even in Christianity, we do have that Jesus alayhi salam did not get married, because mind you, like comparing the Christian faith to the Muslim faith, Isa alayhi salam is still alive, right? So Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala took him. So at whatever years he lived, for 30 or so years on earth, I think
Islam says Jesus was never killed. Right?
Yeah, he was never killed.
They say that
he's alive.
Yeah, they said that he was crucified, and then on Easter Sunday he rose again.
He was resurrected after three days of being crucified. So from an Islamic perspective, Isa alayhi salam is still alive. So for the 30 years or so that he lived, he was amongst people before Allah took him up to the heavens. The conditions and the circumstances he had, I don't think he was, you know, able to get married. So he was single for that. And we have a hadith that says Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will throw like a really massive wedding for Isa alayhi salam, where all the inhabitants of heaven will be gathered and they will celebrate for aeons, like because time is not existence in heaven. So based on that, he was he never got married alayhi salam. So Christianity sees that as a way to to pass that doctrine of theirs that Isa didn't get married, Jesus didn't get married. So the priest who serves the church must resemble Isa in this aspect of his life, that he didn't get married, so you must also
and
not get married.
This is a practice only common in Catholicism, right?
Catholicism. Mainly the Catholic Church, the Roman Catholic Church mainly, the Roman Catholic Church mainly does that celibacy. And they make their priest take a vow of celibacy as well, not just the fact that it's you're a priest, you have to be like Jesus, but also they force them into taking vows of celibacy where they are not allowed to get married.
I see.
And that backfired at them, mind you, terribly.
I know. Because of the scandals, everybody has this.
The scandals are still going. They're not ending. They just keep, shoving it under the carpet kind of thing.
Okay, thank you very much, Sayyid Abdullah and Brother Yasser, for your nice contribution to the program Viewpoints, the movie critique program on RIB English Radio, in which we try to criticize one of those movies with spiritual or religious themes, which was, in this episode, Ouija, Origin of Evil, produced in 2016, directed by Mike Flanagan. Of course, we haven't come to the end of the critique of this movie, and hopefully we'll do that in the upcoming episode. Just try to follow us up to get the rest of this critique. Thank you very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
Want to hear something cool?
Sure.
Do you know what it feels like to be strangled to death? First, you feel the pressure in your throat. And you start to taste something very sour in your mouth. Then, it's like someone lights a match right in the middle of your chest. And that fire grows. It fills your lungs and your throat and all the way behind your eyes. And the last thing you feel is cold. Good night, Romeo.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
In the Limelight.
Six months of the Zionist regime bombardment have left the Gaza Strip in ruins. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye wrote, in a yard surrounding a modest chalet in Gaza's Deir al-Balah, where her parents took shelter from Israeli bombardment, one-year-old Iman al-Saqa takes her first barefoot steps. When she arrived on October 13th, Saqa was wrapped in a blanket and cradled in her mother's arms. Following 6 months of displacement, she now toddles around independently and is beginning to utter her first words. With around 50 other people, this makeshift shelter became home for Iman and her parents after their apartment in Gaza City was reduced to rubble by an Israeli regime airstrike on October 11th. Soheila Al-Saqa, Iman's mother, told Middle East Eye, Iman is my first child. A few months before she was born, we had moved to our new apartment where we designed a pink bedroom for her. We had plans to throw a big party on her birthday. Never did we think that we would not be able to even bake a cake. She added, we were once planning a luxurious life. Instead, I've had to teach her to use the toilet at a very young age since we cannot always find diapers for her. And if we do, they are very expensive. From her shelter in Rafah in the southern Gaza Strip, Zaina Al-Rais curiously tracks the news of the upcoming Tawjihi, the final high school exams for her peers in the occupied West Bank. Before the war on Gaza, she had been gearing up for a pivotal year, setting her sights on being listed among the top students in Palestine's high school examination. However, as the war extends into its seventh month, she laments that both her academic and social life have been put on hold indefinitely. Rais, 17, told Middle East Eye, I haven't only lost 6 months of my life, but an entire year. Tawjihi students in the West Bank have already begun preparing for their exams in around 2 months, while all I am doing here is moving from one shelter to another. When the school year started, I set aside my social life and everything else, determined to focus solely on my studies to achieve a high score that would secure me a scholarship at one of the world's esteemed universities abroad. Today, my entire life has been set aside. Even if the war ends soon, Rais and approximately 620,000 students enrolled in schools in Gaza would not be able to return immediately. At least 351 students have been completely or partially destroyed during the Israeli bombardment of the Gaza Strip over the past 6 months. Among these, 65 are UNRWA-run schools and 286 are government schools, according to the Palestinian Ministry of Education in Gaza. The remaining schools are serving as shelters for hundreds of thousands of displaced people whose homes have been either completely destroyed or damaged by the attacks. Rais, who evacuated her home in Gaza City in the first week of the attacks and since been displaced multiple times, said, in the limited time I am able to connect the internet, it has become my hobby to scroll through Facebook groups of Tawjihi students outside of Gaza. I watch them discuss lessons and ask questions about classes and the expected date of exams. I often cry and my parents wish to do anything to help me continue my education, but they are helpless. Life has stopped. The only thing ongoing here is death. We cannot plan for our next day. How can I plan for my future? Where I would study or what I want to major in? I'm not even sure that I will survive to pass Tawjihi. So far, more than 5,994 Palestinian students and 266 teachers and administrators have been martyred in Gaza. Amid the perpetual sense of insecurity and the relentless sounds of bombardment for 6 consecutive months, Gaza residents find themselves battling in yet another war in their homes and shelters. With essential supplies like electricity, water, fuel, and cooking gas cut off since the first day of the war, every aspect of the residents' daily life becomes a struggle. Samer Al-Agha, originally a resident of Khan Yunis in southern Gaza Strip, currently lives in a tent in Rafah, along with his wife, mother, and 3 children. He told Middle East Eye, "During the first 4 months of the war, there was no cooking gas at all. Everyone in Gaza used either firewood or coal to cook and heat water for bathing. But in the next 2 months, cooking gas has been allowed in, but in very limited amounts. We finally got to buy a gas cylinder at almost 5 or 6 times its original price. But it's okay because even firewood has become very expensive. Without access to running water in any household throughout the Gaza Strip, residents have been relying on water distribution vehicles to refill their tankers for drinking, washing, and bathing." He added, "Since the first day when Israel declared the cutting of our water supply, we knew we would stop having water coming from the top. But we never thought this would continue for 6 months. For half a year, we have been heating water on fire and using empty cans of canned food to pour water for bathing. To wash our clothes, we cannot use washing machines because we neither have electricity nor water, so we have to do it by hand. One would think these are marginal things, but they are not. This is our everyday life, something that we have been sleeping or waking up for half a year. The occupation has made us live a primitive life that even our great-grandparents did not live, and it didn't happen gradually. We suddenly found ourselves living it one day."
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
the death toll for more than 6 months of Israel's indiscriminate bombings of the Gaza Strip tops 33,000.